We have a supersized court report this week, a shocking plea deal in a case that was headed for trial, a surprise federal hearing that could derail another, and a murder-for-hire trial nearly 4 years in the making. Plus, new charges, major legal twists, and a whole lot happening in court. This is the 13th Juror Podcast, where we explore the trials, investigations, and true crime stories that everyone is talking about. I'm your host, Brandi Churchwell, and this is Court Report, your weekly roundup of the biggest courtroom headlines, breaking stories, and the legal developments shaping the nation's most talked about cases. We're starting the week out with a case that we have talked about before on Court Report, because after more than 4 years of court hearings, motions, accusations, and a murder trial that was finally supposed to begin this month, the case against former OnlyFans model Courtney Clinney is officially coming to an end. Courtney appeared in a Miami courtroom Monday morning to enter a plea in connection with the 2020 death of her boyfriend, Christian Obumsele. Now, before we get into exactly what happened during that hearing, I want to back up because this case has taken a lot of turns over the last 4 years. Courtney Clinney was a social media influencer and OnlyFans model who went by the name Courtney Taylor online. At the time of Christian's death, she had more than 2 million followers on Instagram and was making a living through her online presence. From the outside, Courtney and Christian appeared to be this young, attractive couple living a pretty glamorous lifestyle. But behind closed doors, their relationship was incredibly volatile. Now, Courtney and Christian reportedly began their relationship in 2020 and eventually moved from Texas to South Florida in January of 22. They moved into a luxury high-rise apartment in Miami's Edgewater neighborhood, and almost immediately there were problems. Now, this is one of those cases where both sides essentially agreed that the relationship was toxic and sometimes physical. Now, where they disagree was over who was the primary aggressor. Courtney's defense maintained that Christian abused her and that she was afraid of him. Prosecutors and a lot of the evidence painted almost the exact opposite picture. They said that Christian was the victim of domestic violence and that Courtney was the one repeatedly becoming physically aggressive with him. And like I said, there was evidence of violence before Christian's death. Courtney had actually been arrested in Las Vegas in 2021 after an argument with Christian. Now, according to police, Courtney admitted that she threw a glass at him during that altercation. Then, after the couple moved to Miami, surveillance cameras inside their apartment building captured another physical confrontation. In that video, Courtney can be seen attacking Christian in an elevator, and she's like wailing on him. There's also video from a trip that the couple took to Aspen in early 2022. And in that recording, Courtney is angry with Christian and repeatedly tries to hit him as he attempts to block the blows and kind of keep her away from him. And there were audio recordings too. Christian had apparently begun recording some of their arguments on his phone. Now, those recordings captured Courtney screaming and cursing at him during several fights. So by the spring of 2022, this relationship was clearly in trouble. And just 2 days before Christian died, police were called to their apartment building for another domestic disturbance. Courtney told officers that she wanted a restraining order against Christian. Then came April 3rd, 2022. So Courtney and Christian were inside their apartment when another argument began. And what happened during the final moments of that argument became kind of the central dispute in this entire case, because there was never really a question about who caused Christian's fatal injury. Courtney admitted she did it. There was no denying that. The question was whether she murdered him or whether she killed him while trying to defend herself. Now, Courtney told investigators that Christian had attacked her. She said that he pushed her and threw her to the floor. According to Courtney, she eventually grabbed a kitchen knife, and she told detectives that she warned Christian not to come any closer. And when he did, Courtney said that she threw the knife at him. She claimed that she was about 10 feet away from him, and the knife struck Christian in the chest. Now, he was transported to the hospital where he died from his injuries, and he was only 27 years old. Courtney's attorneys would argue that this was self-defense, the tragic end of an abusive relationship in which Courtney believed that she was in danger. But prosecutors said that the physical evidence doesn't match that story. Now, one of the biggest problems for the defense here came from the medical examiner. So the medical examiner testified during Courtney's bond proceedings that Christian's wounds were not consistent with a knife being thrown from across the room. That blade had penetrated his skin and muscle and injured an artery. So when specifically asked whether that fatal wound could have been caused by Courtney just throwing the knife from the distance that she described, the ME was like, nope, not happening. And that became incredibly important because if the knife wasn't just thrown from across the room, then prosecutors could now argue that Courtney's description of those final moments was not true. Now, police initially questioned Courtney after the stabbing, and body cam footage actually showed her sitting inside the apartment and she's like covered in blood, but she wasn't immediately charged with murder. And then months passed and Courtney eventually left Florida and went to Hawaii. Then in August of 2022, prosecutors charged her with second degree murder. Now, she was arrested in Hawaii and brought back to Florida. And from that point forward, Courtney remained in jail without bond. A judge later rejected her attempt to be released while waiting trial. And in that ruling, the court said that based on the evidence presented at the bond hearing, it did not find Courtney's claim of self-defense on April 3rd credible. But the fight over what happened between Courtney and Christian was only kind of the beginning of this legal drama surrounding the case, because then Courtney's parents got arrested too. And okay, y'all, this part gets a little bit complicated. So after Christian died, there was a laptop that had belonged to, or according to the defense, had been shared by Christian and Courtney. Now, law enforcement had apparently left that laptop behind after searching the couple's apartment. Courtney's parents, Kim and Deborah Clinney, eventually ended up with it. So investigators later obtained communications showing Courtney's parents discussing attempts to get into the computer. Now, according to authorities, Courtney eventually provided a 4-digit passcode from jail, and prosecutors believe that the family had accessed Christian's computer without authorization. So in early 2024, arrest warrants were actually issued for Courtney's parents. Kim and Deborah Clinney were arrested in Texas and extradited to Florida, each of them facing a felony charge of unauthorized access to a computer. So Courtney was charged in that computer case as well. And then suddenly prosecutors weren't just trying to prove that Courtney murdered Christian. They were also prosecuting Courtney and her parents over what happened to his laptop after his death. But then the laptop prosecution created an entirely different problem for the state, because in investigating the computer case, prosecutors obtained and reviewed communications between members of the Clinney family and Courtney's attorneys. The defense argued that those conversations were protected by attorney-client privilege and attorney work product protections. So essentially, they're saying you didn't just investigate the laptop. You walked straight into the defense camp and read confidential conversations about how we were defending Courtney in the murder case. And the judge agreed that prosecutors had crossed a line. So in June of 2024, Judge Cruz ruled that protected communications had been improperly accessed. Now, the judge acknowledged that prosecutors may not initially have realized that Courtney's attorneys also represented her parents, but she found that once prosecutors saw that the conversations concerned the homicide defense, they should have stopped and taken the issue to the court rather than continuing to review the communications. Now, the judge excluded key evidence from the computer case, and without that evidence, the computer case essentially just fell apart. So a few weeks later, prosecutors dropped the charges against Courtney and both of her parents. But Courtney's attorneys didn't stop there. They actually argued that the damage had already been done. So their position was that prosecutors working on Courtney's murder case had now been exposed to privileged information about Courtney's defense strategy, including communications involving investigators, potential witnesses, experts, and the defense team's own thoughts about the case. So Courtney's attorneys began fighting to have the Miami-Dade State Attorney's Office removed from the murder prosecution entirely. And all of this created years of litigation surrounding a case that, at its core, still came down to one central question. what happened inside that apartment on April 3rd of 2022. We'll be right back. So let's talk about the two sides of this case and which side the evidence supports. Now, the state's case was that Courtney was the aggressor in a long, volatile relationship, and ultimately she stabbed Christian during another violent confrontation. And the defense's case was that Courtney was trapped in an abusive relationship and Christian attacked her that day and she used the knife because she believed that she needed to defend herself. And there was evidence that both sides were prepared to use to tell different versions of the same relationship. But prosecutors had the elevator surveillance video. They had the Aspen video showing Courtney striking Christian. They had Christian's recordings of their arguments. They had the medical examiner challenging Courtney's account of throwing the knife. And they had all of the circumstances surrounding the stabbing itself. But the videos and recordings weren't the only evidence that prosecutors had of violence in this relationship, because Christian's own text messages actually documented what he said were previous attacks by Courtney. This gets a little bit wild. Okay, so in one exchange, Christian and Courtney are talking, and Christian said that Courtney had stabbed him badly enough that he could barely walk. And then in another, he described being hit in the head by her and bleeding and vomiting, and told Courtney that he believed he had a concussion. And then, just a couple of months before his death, Christian ended up in the hospital with two significant cuts to his face that required stitches. And their text messages afterward are really disturbing. So Courtney told him essentially, yeah, go enjoy the hospital. And Christian told her that he wasn't going to tell anyone what really happened. He would just say it was a football injury. Now, later, Christian talked about being in that hospital and getting stitched up because he had lost so much blood. And Courtney eventually apologized, telling him that she should have been there with him and that she was so sorry for hurting him and all of that. Now, when prosecutors argued that Christian was actually the victim of domestic violence in this relationship, they weren't solely relying on what happened the night he died, because they had all of these videos and audio recordings, and the recordings even capture Courtney yelling racial slurs and threatening behavior and possible verbal and emotional abuse. I say possible, but I mean, y'all look at the videos. You tell me. And they also had Christian's own messages written months before his death describing these injuries that he attributed to Courtney and that Courtney's basically admitting to in these text messages. So the defense, meanwhile, was preparing to put the entire relationship under a microscope and argue that these isolated videos, all of them, all of these many, many isolated videos of Courtney behaving violently did not tell the jurors what was happening behind closed doors or what Courtney believed was happening in the moments immediately before Christian was stabbed. And look, I get that people are complex and there's no such thing as a perfect victim. We all have flaws and we all react in different ways, and you could potentially nitpick anything, like if he yelled back at her or pushed her in the elevator when she was attacking him. But y'all, there is no evidence that we have seen anyway that suggests Christian is in any way the villain in this situation. If you look at the original interview that Courtney did with police, she pretty much said this twice. The first time when she tells officers that they got in a fight and she just overreacted, I mean, that's pretty much an admission right there. And then the second time when she says that she didn't know if it was justified, I mean, what else do you have to say? If she were truly in fear for her life and needed to use deadly force, she wouldn't have just said that she overreacted. She told on herself in those moments because she didn't know at that point that Christian wasn't going to make it. They actually told her that he had passed away during her police interview. And I watched that tape, and I think that's the first moment that it really hit her about what she had done. But you can't rewrite the truth to avoid accountability. I mean, honestly, that's a slap in the face to everyone who has actually suffered from domestic violence. It diminishes the gravity of what the actual victim went through. because it's not only a lie, it's an attempt to hijack the role of the victim while trying to justify his murder. You're stealing the voice of the real victim and turning his pain into your defense. So, I don't know. But that's where this was going. And the trial was finally approaching. So Courtney had spent roughly 4 years behind bars waiting for this. And then at the end of July came the announcement, there's not going to be a trial. I honestly was expecting another delay because that's what we've been dealing with for the last few years. But they said no trial. Courtney Clinney had reached a plea agreement with prosecutors. So both sides initially kept the terms confidential, saying that they would not become final unless and until the judge accepted the agreement in court. So on Monday, August 10th, exactly 4 years to the day after Courtney's arrest, Courtney Clinney walked back into a Miami courtroom to resolve this case without a jury ever deciding whether Christian Ogunseli's death was murder or self-defense. And now we finally know what she agreed to. So Courtney pleaded guilty to manslaughter with a deadly weapon. As part of the plea agreement, Courtney admitted that she caused the stab wound that ultimately killed Christian. In exchange for that guilty plea, prosecutors agreed to a sentence of 6 years in Florida State Prison, followed by 5 years of probation. And there are some pretty significant conditions attached to that probation. But there's more to this. Okay, so Courtney will be required to undergo a mental health evaluation, thank goodness, a substance abuse evaluation, and any recommended treatment. And she will also be required to complete a batterer's intervention program. Now, if she leaves Florida and later violates her probation, then she has agreed to waive extradition and be returned to Florida. And if she violates the terms of that probation, the consequences could be pretty substantial because the judge made it clear that Courtney could ultimately face up to 30 years in prison. But here's the part that really stood out to me about this sentence. So Courtney was arrested in Hawaii August 10th, 2022. This hearing took place August 10th, 2026. So, like I said, exactly 4 years later. And Courtney is receiving credit for the 4 years that she has already spent behind bars. So, although the sentence is 6 years, assuming that she receives that full credit and there aren't other factors affecting her release date, she has approximately 2 years remaining on that sentence. Now, before accepting the plea, the judge went through the standard questions with Courtney to make sure that she understood exactly what she was doing and that she was entering into this plea knowingly and voluntarily. So Courtney was sworn in, and when the judge asked whether she had ever been diagnosed with a mental illness, Courtney said that she had been diagnosed with severe PTSD. But she told the court that she understood the proceedings, and today she was ready to finally take criminal responsibility for Christian's death by pleading guilty to manslaughter with a deadly weapon. Now, there was also an interesting issue raised involving Florida's version of the Son of Sam law, essentially restrictions intended to prevent someone convicted of a crime from financially profiting from that crime. So the state made clear that this provision was not something negotiated as part of Courtney's plea agreement. Rather, it attaches automatically under the law. And Courtney's defense attorneys actually kind of indicated that they believe that there are some constitutional problems with that provision. Now, that's a fight for another day, but I will be interested to see what happens there because, to me, this is pure speculation. It seemed like they were already kind of setting the stage for some kind of plan that she has, whether it's going to be a book or maybe some more OnlyFans material. I don't know what this heifer has planned, but I thought that was very interesting. So we'll see what happens there. Now, once all of those legal details were handled, the hearing moved to what, for me, was the most important part. This is when Christian's family finally got to speak. So Christian's mom told the court that there was just too much pain to pour onto paper. And one of the details that she shared about the day that her son died was just heartbreaking. So she said that she was at work when she received a phone call asking whether she would consent to donating Christian's eyes. The problem was she did not even know yet that her son was dead. She had spoken to Christian the night before, and then suddenly she's getting this phone call about donating his organs. And she described that as like the darkest day of her life. And she said that there was a joy in her life before Christian died that it just never returned. And this loss wasn't experienced by just one person. Christian had an older brother, and he had cousins who were raised alongside him, almost like siblings. And he had a grandmother who called him her precious. I thought that was so cute. So his death left an empty place in an entire family that they know will never be filled. And Christian's mother made it clear that while today's plea deal may close the legal chapter of this case, it does not close the grief. And she ended simply, "We miss you. We love you. May you rest in peace." And there was one other statement from Christian's family that was read into the record by their attorney. And this one was much more pointed. The family said that Christian loved deeply, and they believe that love is exactly what kept him in a relationship that had already become violent. And then they referenced something that Christian himself had written before his death. So according to the statement, Christian wrote that his love would eventually get him killed. Now, think about that. His family believes that Christian predicted his own death at the hands of Courtney Clinney. So for Courtney Clinney, today's hearing provides something that she hasn't had since her arrest 4 years ago, an end date. But for Christian's family, there isn't one. And I think his mother's statement probably said it better than anything else could. The legal case is over, but the grief isn't. We'll be right back. All right, moving into new charges filed this week. We have a brand new case out of Massachusetts, and this one caught my attention for a couple of reasons. 17-year-old Arjun Aravand has been charged with murdering his mother and his 14-year-old younger brother inside their home in Massachusetts. And prosecutors say that before these murders, Arjun has been using the internet, and specifically ChatGPT, to search for what they described as theoretical ideas or fantasy stories about killing his family. So here's what we know so far. On Tuesday, August 11th, Arjun's father contacted police after becoming concerned about his family. A tutor had apparently gone to the family's home but couldn't get inside, and Arjun's father repeatedly tried to contact the people inside the house but couldn't reach anyone. So eventually, he asked police to conduct a welfare check. Well, when officers entered the home, they found Arjun's 14-year-old brother, Siddharth Aravind, dead on the floor. This is on the first floor of the home. So they continued searching the house, and then they found Arjun's mother, 45-year-old Sudha Venkatesan, dead in the basement. Prosecutors say that there were obvious signs of struggle inside that home, and both victims had suffered significant trauma. At Arjun's arraignment on Thursday, prosecutors said that evidence at the scene indicated that blunt force trauma was used in some fashion against both victims. And although their official causes of death have not been determined by the medical examiner at the time of this recording, that's what we know. So I don't know, but Arjun wasn't there when they got there. So his mother's car was also missing. And several hours later, at around 3:40 on Wednesday morning, police actually located Arjun inside his mother's vehicle in a parking lot in nearby Wayland, Massachusetts, and they took him into custody. So prosecutors say they also recovered items from that car that corresponded with evidence found at the murder scene. But what makes this case particularly interesting is what investigators say was happening before the killings. So according to the Middlesex County District Attorney, Arjun had recently been demonstrating what she called, quote unquote, concerning behaviors, which included internet searches and the use of ChatGPT to explore theoretical ideas or create fantasy stories involving the killings of his family. And apparently, his father had already noticed enough concerning behavior that he was worried. Court records show that his father had become concerned about Arjun's internet activity and had actually begun hiding the knives inside the home. Now, we don't know exactly what he searched for or what he said to ChatGPT or what responses he received or what connection, if any, prosecutors will ultimately try to establish between those conversations and these murders. So those are going to be very important distinctions as this case moves forward. And y'all, we don't even know a motive yet. Arjun appeared in court on Thursday where a not guilty plea was entered on his behalf to two counts of murder, as well as assault and battery charges. His defense attorney agreed that he should remain held without bail, but she also requested that he undergo a mental health evaluation. So when the judge asked whether she was requesting an evaluation of his competency to stand trial or his criminal responsibility at the time of the alleged offenses, the attorney was like, TBD. And his attorney also told reporters afterward that Arjun did not realize that his mother and brother were dead when he left the house, and he described him as being in a state of shock. Now, obviously, that's the defense attorney's characterization at this point, and prosecutors are presenting a very different picture. Arjun is also facing additional charges related to his mom's car in juvenile court, but because those proceedings are closed to the public, there's not really a lot of information available about that portion of the case. But his next major court date is a probable cause hearing scheduled for September 11th. And this is definitely one I want to keep an eye on because we're only 2 days into this case at the time of this recording. So we don't have autopsy results. We don't have a motive. We don't even know what was contained in those ChatGPT conversations. But if prosecutors ultimately intend to use those conversations as evidence of planning or intent, or Arjun's state of mind before the killings, then I think that we're going to be hearing a whole lot more about them. All right, let's move into appeals and legal twists. We have an update in the Alex Burdock case. And at this point, I don't think that anybody listening to a true crime podcast actually needs for me to give you the entire Murdoch backstory. We have been talking about this man for years. So let's just pick up with where we are now. Now, as we've talked about before, Murdoch's murder convictions were overturned earlier this year because of the jury tampering issues involving former Colleton County Clerk of Court Becky Hill. Now, that means that the state is preparing to try him again for the murders of his wife, Maggie, and son, Paul. And that retrial is tentatively scheduled for April 5th of 2027. But this week, there has been a flurry of new filings, and Murdoch's attorneys are now arguing that the retrial shouldn't happen at all. They have filed a motion asking the judge to dismiss the murder indictments entirely based on what they say happened when the case was originally presented to the grand jury. And the allegations here are pretty serious. So the defense is accusing former SLED lead investigator David Owen of presenting false information to the grand jury that indicted Murdoch. One of the biggest issues involves the white t-shirt that Murdoch was wearing on the night that Maggie and Paul were killed. So early in the investigation, there was a theory that high-velocity blood spatter from one of the victims had been found on that shirt, which, I mean, obviously would be incredibly powerful physical evidence, placing Alex very close to the shooting. But that theory ultimately fell apart. Testing did not establish that the shirt contained high-velocity blood spatter, and prosecutors did not use that evidence at Murdoch's first trial. Now, the defense says now that Owen nevertheless told the grand jury that Maggie's blood was on Alex's shirt and that the pattern was consistent with someone who had been close to her when she was shot. They also accuse him of giving false or misleading testimony about other evidence, including the ammunition allegedly connecting the weapons at the Murdoch property to the crime. And Murdoch's attorneys say that that matters because this wasn't just a mistake that happened during an investigation. They argue that allegedly false information was presented directly to the grand jury responsible for deciding whether there was probable cause to indict Alex for murder. So their position is essentially, if the indictments themselves were obtained through fabricated or false evidence, then they should be dismissed. Now, obviously, Creighton Waters and the state are expected to fight that. And even if the judge doesn't throw the case out, the issue could still become very important during the retrial because it gives the defense another way to attack the integrity of the original investigation. But while the two sides are fighting about whether there should even be a retrial, they're also fighting over where to put it. Murdoch's attorneys want the trial moved out of Colleton County. They argue that between the enormous amount of publicity and Murdoch's family history in that area and everything that happened with Becky Hill during the first trial, it will be impossible to seat a truly impartial jury there. And their preferred destination is Charleston County. Now, the state originally indicated that it was open to moving the trial, but now prosecutors say that the defense has basically taken a Charleston or bust position, and they're pushing back. Now, some of the reasons are honestly just practical. Remember, when this retrial is scheduled for is April 5th of 2027, so that puts it right around Masters Week. Now, prosecutors say that Charleston is already one of the most difficult and expensive places in the state to accommodate a trial, especially of this magnitude. Hotels during spring tourism season and Masters Week could cost two or three times what they would elsewhere. And then you have downtown Charleston traffic and limited parking and the enormous number of attorneys, witnesses, jurors, media, and spectators expected to attend this trial. And prosecutors even pointed out that Charleston regularly deals with flooding from heavy spring rains and king tides, which can shut down streets and make getting around downtown even more difficult. So basically, the state's like, if you really can't get a fair trial in Colleton County, fine, we can talk about moving it, but it doesn't have to be Charleston. And I get it. Yeah, Charleston would be really difficult. But also, I began my career with the Murdaugh trial, and I began it with a longtime best friend and former college roommate who lives in Charleston and is in the legal world. So I'm going to tell y'all, if it does end up there, Carla, clear out the guest room because I'm coming to stay for a while. But we'll see what happens. Now, prosecutors have suggested other possibilities, including Spartanburg, York, and Florence counties. And all of this is coming to a head pretty quickly because Murdaugh is scheduled to be back in court Friday morning, August 14th, for another pretrial hearing. So, once again, more than 5 years after Maggie and Paul were killed, and more than 3 years after Murdaugh was originally convicted, we are somehow right back here arguing over the evidence, the investigation, where to hold the trial, and now whether the indictments should survive at all. And with the retrial still about 8 months away, I have a feeling that this is only the beginning of all this pretrial fighting. So I'll update y'all on the hearing in next week's episode. All right, our other legal twist this week takes us back to Florida, where a man accused of murdering an attorney has decided that when he goes to trial next month, he doesn't need a lawyer, because apparently being a plastic surgeon is close enough. This is the case of Dr. Thomas Kozowski, who is charged with first-degree murder in the disappearance and presumed death of 41-year-old attorney Stephen Causey. And if you don't remember this one, the circumstances surrounding Causey's disappearance are actually pretty wild. So back in March of 2023, Causey was working at a law firm in Largo, Florida. He was actually representing a client involved in a long-running civil lawsuit against Kozowski over medical billing and money that Kozowski believed he was owed. So on March 21st, Causey disappeared from his law office. His wallet, keys, and cell phone were reportedly still sitting on his desk, but Causey was gone. Investigators say that surveillance video showed Kozowski arriving at the office wearing gloves and carrying a large backpack. According to prosecutors, he and Causey participated in a conference call involving that civil case, and then shortly afterward, investigators believe that Kozowski attacked and killed Causey inside that office. Police found a significant amount of blood in the bathroom, and prosecutors say that surveillance video later showed Kozowski struggling with this large, heavy, like cart or container or something as he left the building. Investigators say they also tracked Kozowski to a remote area along the Tamiami Trail in South Florida after Causey disappeared. But Stephen Causey's body has never been found, and Kozowski was arrested several days later and charged with first-degree murder. So now, more than 3 years later, that case is finally scheduled to go to trial on September 14th. Except, there's been one little complication. Kozowski has decided that he's going to represent himself. At a hearing last Thursday, Kozowski told the judge that he no longer wanted attorneys Daniel Hernandez and Jane McNeil representing him. And y'all, this isn't exactly the first time that Kozowski has had problems with his defense team. He hasn't reached like Sarah Boone level yet, but I mean, this ain't the first time. There have been multiple changes in representation during the 3+ years that this case has been pending. And Kozowski has actually represented himself during portions of the pretrial proceedings before. But now he wants to take that all the way to trial. And remember, this is a first-degree murder case. The state is seeking the death penalty, which makes another part of what Kozowski told the judge really interesting or stupid or disturbing, whatever you want to call it. According to Court TV, Kozlowski said that he does not want his attorneys presenting mitigation evidence during a potential penalty phase. So, in other words, if he's convicted and this case reaches the point where jurors are deciding whether he should be sentenced to death, Kozlowski is like, no, I don't want my attorneys presenting evidence intended to convince the jury to spare my life. So the judge went through the process of making sure that Kozlowski understood what he was giving up by representing himself, and he insisted that he did. And at one point, when the judge questioned whether handling a death penalty murder trial without an attorney was really in his best interest, Kozlowski responded, yeah, makes sense to me. So, barring another change between now and September, we could have a plastic surgeon standing in a Florida courtroom next month defending himself against allegations that he murdered the attorney who was representing his opponent in a civil lawsuit, then disposed of his body, and then left investigators with a murder case in which the victim has never been found. You can't make this stuff up. And if you've watched enough trials with me, you already know that a defendant representing himself in a murder trial is always something to watch. This one starts September 14th. We'll be right back. Let's talk about cases making headlines this week. I want to move into a case that I actually have not covered much yet on Court Report, but that is probably about to change because the state murder trial of Luigi Mangione is scheduled to begin in less than a month. And this week, there was a pretty major development that could potentially throw that entire trial into question. But since we haven't really covered this case before, let me give you a little bit of background first. So on the morning of December 4th, 2024, Brian Thompson, the CEO of United Healthcare, was walking toward the Hilton Hotel in Midtown Manhattan, where his company was holding an investor conference. So just before 7 a.m., a masked gunman approached Thompson from behind and shot him multiple times. Now, the shooting was captured on surveillance video, and police immediately believed that this was not random, that Thompson had been specifically targeted. So investigators found something at the scene that made this case even more unusual. Words had been written on shell casings recovered near Thompson's body, including delay, deny, and depose. So very quickly, those words became part of the story surrounding this case because the phrase delay, deny, defend has long been associated with criticism of insurance companies and their claims practices. And remember, Thompson was the CEO of United Healthcare. So the shooter escaped, and what followed was a massive 5-day manhunt. Police released surveillance images of the person that they believed was responsible. And then on December 9th, nearly 300 miles away in Allatoona, Pennsylvania, an employee at a McDonald's recognized a man who looked like the person in those images and called the police. That man was Luigi Mangione. According to investigators, when Mangione was arrested, they recovered a loaded firearm and suppressor, fake identification, and writings that prosecutors say demonstrated hostility toward the health insurance industry. Now, Mangione was eventually brought back to New York, and this is where this case gets a little complicated because Luigi Mangione is not just facing one prosecution. He is being prosecuted by both the state of New York and the federal government, and those are two completely separate cases. So let's start with New York. Manhattan prosecutors originally charged Mangione with 11 counts, including first-degree murder in furtherance of terrorism and second-degree murder as a crime of terrorism. But in September of 2025, the judge dismissed both of those terrorism-related murder charges. The judge found that the prosecutors had not presented legally sufficient evidence to establish the terrorism component required under New York law. But, and this is important, that did not mean that the murder case was dismissed. The judge specifically found that there was legally sufficient evidence supporting the remaining charges, including intentional second-degree murder. So Mangione is still facing that murder charge, along with weapons and forgery-related charges, and he has pleaded not guilty. And the state murder trial is now right around the corner. Mangione was back in state court on Tuesday, August 11th, and Judge Caro confirmed that jury selection is scheduled to begin on September 8th. And we also learned this week that this will be an anonymous jury. The names and addresses of the jurors will not be publicly disclosed because the judge found that there was a realistic risk of harassment, intimidation, or improper outside influence. And if y'all followed this case at all, you probably understand why that has become such a concern. Mangione has developed an enormous and kind of unusual following since his arrest. Supporters regularly gather outside the courthouse when he appears, and prosecutors have raised concerns about some people encouraging jury nullification. And basically, jury nullification is when a juror believes that the defendant technically broke the law, but votes to acquit anyway because they disagree with the law or because they believe that applying it in that particular case would be unjust. So Mangione's attorneys have made clear that they are not affiliated with those people or those efforts. So as of Tuesday, everything seemed to be moving forward toward a September 8th murder trial. But remember, that's only one of the cases against him. At the same time that Manhattan prosecutors have been pursuing that state murder case, the federal government has been pursuing its own prosecution. Mangione was originally indicted federally on 4 counts. That was 2 stalking charges, a firearms offense, and murder through the use of a firearm. And originally, the federal case carried something the New York case did not, and that's the possibility of the death penalty. So in April of 2025, then Attorney General Pam Bondi directed federal prosecutors to seek the death penalty against Mangione. But that changed dramatically earlier this year. In January, U.S. District Judge Margaret Garnett dismissed 2 of the 4 federal counts. That includes the murder through use of a firearm charge and the related firearms offense. So the legal issue basically came down to whether the stalking offenses could legally serve as the underlying, quote unquote, crime of violence necessary to support those additional charges. And the judge concluded that they could not. So when those charges went away, the death penalty went away with them. So Mangione is not facing the death penalty anymore, but that doesn't mean that the federal case isn't serious. He still faces 2 federal stalking charges related to Thompson's death. And those charges can still expose him to the possibility of spending the rest of his life in prison. Which brings us to what happened this week. So just one day after Mangione appeared in state court and everything seemed to be moving full steam ahead toward his September murder trial, an unexpected hearing appeared on his federal court calendar. So a conference was scheduled for Friday, August 14th. And what immediately caught everyone's attention was that this wasn't just a hearing scheduled by the judge. The conference was requested jointly by federal prosecutors and Mangione's defense attorneys. Now that immediately started speculation that the two sides could be working on a plea agreement. Now as of the time of this recording, Thursday, August 13th, that speculation has gotten considerably stronger. Multiple outlets are now reporting that Mangione is expected to plead guilty to the remaining federal charges during Friday's hearing. But I want to be very clear here. As I'm recording this, that plea has not happened yet. So neither Mangione nor the judge has formally entered or accepted a guilty plea. And the complete terms of any potential agreement have not been made public. We all just out here speculating. So until Mangione actually stands in that courtroom on Friday and potentially enters a plea, nothing's final. But if he does plead guilty, things could get interesting very quickly. Because remember what I told you at the beginning, his state murder trial starts September 8th. So let's talk about the whole double jeopardy question. Now, normally you might hear double jeopardy and think, okay, well, if he pleads guilty federally for conduct related to Brian Thompson's death, how can New York turn around and prosecute him for that same killing? Well, apparently under federal constitutional law, ordinarily they can. There's something called dual sovereignty doctrine, which essentially recognizes the federal government and state government as separate sovereigns. So generally speaking, a federal prosecution does not automatically prevent a state from bringing its own prosecution arising from the same conduct. But New York makes this more complicated. Of course. So New York has its own statutory protections against successive prosecutions, and those protections can be broader than what the federal constitution requires. And according to reporting about these plea negotiations, if Mangione pleads guilty federally, his attorneys could attempt to use that plea to argue that New York law prevents Manhattan prosecutors from moving forward with the state murder case. It's all wild, right? Now, that doesn't mean that the state case automatically disappears. Far from it. The Manhattan District Attorney's Office is expected to fight any attempt to dismiss its case. And exactly what Mangione pleads guilty to, and potentially even the facts that he admits to during that plea, could become incredibly important in determining what happens next. So think about where this leaves us. We are less than a month away from jury selection in a murder trial that has been preparing to go forward for well over a year. The judge has now finalized major trial logistics, and we know that jury selection begins September 8th, and we know that the jury will be anonymous. Both sides have been litigating evidence back and forth and preparing for this trial. And now suddenly, the feds pop in and like, hey, we're meeting on Friday. And now there's multiple outlets reporting that he's expected to walk into that courtroom and plead guilty. And if that happens, his attorneys could then turn around and argue that the federal conviction prevents New York from prosecuting him for Brian Thompson's murder. It's so wild. So whether that argument would actually succeed is an entirely different question. And I suspect that if they make it, we are going to see some pretty significant litigation over it. This is going to get really big, really fast. But either way, it's going to be a very important day in this case on Friday, because we may find out not only whether Mangione is willing to admit guilt in the federal prosecution, but whether that plea becomes the defense's next weapon in trying to stop the state murder trial that is supposed to begin in just a few weeks. And obviously, I'll keep you updated here. We'll be right back. All right, let's talk about cases to watch next week. And for this one, we are heading back to Florida. Don't we spend so much time in Florida and Massachusetts lately? I feel like that's the only cases I'm covering now. All right, so this is one that has been 4 years in the making. This is the murder of Jared Bradigan. And next week, the first of three defendants accused in what prosecutors have described as an elaborate murder-for-hire plot will finally go to trial. So let me remind you what happened here. On February 16th, 2022, 33-year-old Jared Bradigan had taken his then 9-year-old twins out for what he called a date night. Super cute dad thing to do, right? Well, afterward, he dropped them off at the Jacksonville Beach home of his ex-wife, Shanna Gardner. Now, Jared then started driving home towards St. Augustine with his 2-year-old daughter, Bexley, strapped into her car seat behind him. But he never made it home. As Jared drove through the Sanctuary neighborhood along his normal route, he came across a tire sitting in the middle of the road. So he stopped his SUV and he got out to move it. And that's when he was ambushed. Jared was shot multiple times and killed right there in the street with his 2-year-old daughter still sitting in the car just feet away. In fact, investigators say that at least one of those bullets came within inches of Bexley. And police eventually determined that the tire was not there by accident. They believe that it had been deliberately placed in Jared's path to force him to stop his car and get out. According to prosecutors, this was not a random murder. They allege that it was a murder-for-hire plot involving Jared's ex-wife, Shanna Gardner, her then-husband, Mario Fernandez Saldana, and Henry Tenen, a man who had been renting a property from Fernandez. Now, Jared and Shanna had been involved in an ongoing and very contentious custody dispute over their twins, and prosecutors allege that Shanna and Fernandez orchestrated this plan to have Jared killed. So according to the state, Fernandez hired Tenen to carry out the murder. Now, Tenen was the first person arrested, and initially it looked like he was going to become one of the most important witnesses in this entire case. In 2023, Tenen pleaded guilty to second-degree murder and admitted that he was the person who shot Jared, and he agreed to cooperate with prosecutors. Fernandez and Shanna were later arrested and both pleaded not guilty. So for years, the expectation was that Henry Tenen would eventually take the stand against them. But earlier this year, this case took a major turn. Tenen withdrew his guilty plea. He changed his plea back to not guilty, Uno reversed it, and he is now saying that his previous statements were all false. And that has completely changed everything about this case. So Shanna, the ex-wife, and Fernandez, her then-husband, had originally been expected to be tried at the same time, but with separate juries. And then Tenen was supposed to testify at that trial. So we were looking at one trial. But that arrangement was contingent on Tenen testifying. Once Tenen backed out of his plea agreement, prosecutors and the defense agreed that Shanna and Fernandez should instead be tried separately. And Fernandez is going first. This is Mario Fernandez. Now, as we head into that trial, there is now another pretty major development in the state's theory of exactly what happened on the night that Jared was killed. Because for years, the basic understanding of this case was that Henry Tenen was allegedly waiting near that tire, and then Jared stopped, got out of his SUV, and then Tenen shot him, and then the shooter escaped. But prosecutors now say that Tenen was not alone at the scene. Assistant State Attorney Alan Mizrahi recently revealed that investigators believe that there were actually two people involved in the ambush itself. Now, the state says that Tenen was the person who pulled the trigger. They say that they have Tenen's DNA on the tire that was placed in Jared's path. But prosecutors now say that after the shooting, Tenen fled the scene on foot. Now, at the same time, another person allegedly drove away from the area in a pickup truck that had been captured on surveillance video. And that's significant because for years, that truck had been discussed as the suspect, you know, the shooter's getaway vehicle. And now prosecutors are saying that the evidence shows that Tenen wasn't driving it. So that's a huge bombshell. Meaning, according to the state, there was another person at or near that murder scene. And right now, prosecutors have not publicly identified who they believe was behind the wheel of that truck. They also have not publicly said whether or not it was Mario Fernandez. So I think that this is going to be one of the biggest things to listen for when this trial begins. Who does the state believe was driving that truck? And more importantly, what evidence do they have connecting that second person and Mario Fernandez to this murder? Because remember, person prosecutors say actually pulled the trigger is no longer cooperating with them. The state once expected Tenen to sit in front of a jury and help explain how all of this alleged murder-for-hire plot all worked. And now Tenen is saying that his previous statements were false, he's going to trial himself, and prosecutors have to prove their case against Fernandez without the cooperating witness that they once thought that they had. And that brings us to where things stand right now. So jury selection for Mario Fernandez's trial is actually happening this week. In fact, as I'm sitting here working on this episode, I got the notification that the jury had been seated. So the trial itself is scheduled to begin on Monday, August 17th. Fernandez was originally facing four charges, but prosecutors recently dropped two of them. They dropped the conspiracy to commit murder and child abuse. So he will now stand trial on first-degree murder and solicitation to commit a capital felony. And although prosecutors initially intended to seek the death penalty in this case, they have since taken the death penalty off the table. So Fernandez has pleaded not guilty, and his trial is currently scheduled to run through August 28th. So it's supposed to start on Monday the 17th and then go till August 28th. Okay, so that's trial one. Then just days later, jury selection begins for Shanna Gardner. Now, her jury selection is scheduled for August 31st through September 4th, with her trial beginning September 8th. And Henry Tenen, the man that prosecutors accuse of pulling the trigger, will now face his own trial in March of 2027. So instead of one enormous murder-for-hire trial, we are now looking at three separate trials, and the first one starts next week. It's like Adelson drama all over again, trial after trial for a murder-for-hire. And I think that there are three really big questions going into this. Can prosecutors prove that Mario Fernandez helped orchestrate Jared's murder without Henry Tenen cooperating with them? Number two, who was the second person prosecutors say was at the scene when Jared was killed? Was it Fernandez? And what evidence does the state have that ties all of these people together? So those are the things that I'm going to be watching when this trial begins next week. And considering that Shanna Gardner's trial is scheduled to begin just a few weeks after this one ends, I have a feeling that we're going to be talking about this case quite a bit over the next month. Now, obviously, another big trial that we're watching right now very closely is Lindsey Clancy. And that trial is really starting to heat up. This week, we have gotten deep into Lindsey's mental health treatment in the months leading up to the deaths of her children. We've had her doctors, medications, hospitalizations, and the symptoms that she was reporting along the way. And we've also heard incredibly emotional testimony from the medical examiners. And now investigators are beginning to walk jurors through Lindsey's digital footprint, including her internet searches, cell phone data, and writings from the weeks and days before January 24th of 2023. So there is a lot coming out of this testimony, way more than I could ever adequately cover in a few minutes here on Court Report. So if you're following the Lindsey Clancy trial with me, make sure you check out my full-length 13th Juror episodes just dedicated to that trial. I'm doing a deep dive every week, breaking down the testimony and the evidence, and most importantly, what each side is trying to prove with it. And because we're getting to the point in this trial where all of those pieces that we've been collecting are really starting to come together, it's been kind of crazy, but there's still a whole lot more to come. So make sure you check those episodes out. All right, and before we get out of here, let's do something a little new this week. There are several stories that weren't quite big enough for their own full section, but I still want to make sure that they're on your radar. So these are our juror notes, the quick things that you need to know before we adjourn Court Report for the week. First, Tyler Robinson. So following that massive preliminary hearing in the Charlie Kirk case, Robinson's attorneys have now filed a brief asking the judge to take the death penalty off the table. And the defense is challenging the aggravating circumstance that prosecutors are relying on to make Robinson death penalty eligible, specifically the allegation that the shooting created a great risk of death to other people. So his attorneys argue that because a single shot was fired downward from the rooftop toward Kirk, prosecutors have not shown that the shooting created the kind of risk to others that would be required under Utah law. So we'll see what the judge does with that. Oral arguments following the preliminary hearing are now scheduled for September 1st. Next, Tiffany Haddish, the comedian and actress best known for movies in Girls Trip and Night School, has finally resolved her Georgia DUI case this week, stemming from her January 2022 arrest. Now, she pleaded guilty Tuesday to a misdemeanor alcohol-related driving charge and avoided additional jail time. But honestly, the reason that you may have already seen this story has less to do with the plea itself and more to do with the video of the hearing. Because Tiffany Haddish was very much Tiffany Haddish throughout the whole thing. She joked with the judge and at one point was just like, yeah, I'm just going to go ahead and agree. And clips from that hearing have been making their way around the internet. So if you need a little courtroom comic relief after everything else that we've talked about, there you go. Next up, Joseph and Kendra Duggar have resolved their Arkansas child endangerment case this week. Now, if the Duggar name sounds familiar, Joseph is one of the 19 children. 19 children. That's a whole lot of youngins. Joseph is one of the 19 children of Jim Bob and Michelle Duggar, the family made famous by the TLC reality shows 19 Kids and Counting, and then later, I guess there was a spinoff called Counting On. So Joseph and his wife Kendra also appeared on the shows before the family's reality TV career came to an end. Now, the couple withdrew their not guilty pleas to charges that included endangering the welfare of a minor and false imprisonment. The judge granted them a one-year diversion, allowing them to avoid jail as long as they successfully comply with the terms of the agreement. So we'll have to see what happens when that one-year period is up. And finally, QVD jury selection is underway in Vegas in the long-awaited trial of the 1996 murder of Tupac. And when I say long-awaited, I mean we're talking about a murder that happened like 30 years ago. So opening statements are expected Monday, and the media presence surrounding this case is already enormous. There are going to be some really fascinating evidentiary issues here, including QVD's own interviews, public statements, and that tell-all memoir in which he discussed his alleged involvement in what happened that night. Side note, maybe don't publish a tell-all memoir if you're going to include evidence and alleged admissions that can be used against you in a high-profile murder trial. Just throwing ideas out there. Brainstorming. So between QVD, Mario Fernandez in the Jared Bridegan case, and everything continuing to unfold in Lindsey Clancy's trial, next week is going to be very busy, and I'm ready for it. that's your court report for this week. I'll be back next week with the latest developments. Until then, keep asking questions, keep looking at the evidence, and decide for yourself what you believe. My name is Brandi Churchwell, creator and host of the 13th Juror podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to follow the show on your favorite podcast platform and leave a rating or review. For additional episodes, case updates, and more information about the podcast, visit our website at 13thjurorpodcast.com. The evidence has been presented, the arguments have been made, and now comes the same question faced by every juror. What do you believe? Thank you for listening.